Before I start my talk, I'd like to make two disclaimers. First, I'm not speaking on behalf of ASA as executive director. These opinions are my own and not that of the ASA. Secondly, I'm not an information theorist. Most of what I know from information, I gathered from the information theory group at Thomas J. Watson Research Center, which reported to me at that time. Now, the objectives of this talk are, first of all, to assess the claim that new functional information can only arise from an intelligent agent, and secondly, to identify the source of new functional, specifically in DNA, information. Consider these assertions. New information can only arise from an intelligent source. All our experience shows that information arises only from an intelligent source. And these assertions typically have a modifier in front of information, an adjective that includes the word complex plus one or more of the following: functional, specified, meaningful, useful, valuable, whatever. These are important modifiers for these assertions. This is typically the public version. This the basic version of the information argument for intelligent design. And it is usually used in the context of the origin of life or in rapid changes like the Cambrian explosion and other areas to indicate, infer why an intelligent agent is needed for this explosion of information. Now, let me start by showing you the four messages of this talk. The first message is that these assertions, the information argument for intelligent design, are not based on standard information theory, but they're based on two things. One is a probability argument, and secondly, a claim of a necessary linkage between functional information and intelligent agents. This message, as far as I can understand it, is not disputed, not controversial. Everyone agrees with this. Which cannot be said for the other messages. Message two, I'll say those probability arguments aren't valid in the case of evolution. Third, I'm going to say that in contrast to part B, that intelligent agents are not necessarily linked to the generation of functional information. And the fourth one will indicate how biological information arises at each reproductive event. So first of all, let's think a little bit about information. Just a brief introduction here, that standard information theory deals with information that most famously Claude Shannon, the communications engineer from Bell Labs, who wrote his seminal paper in 1948 that really kicked off the era of information theory. And that theory deals with information as quantified by this simple version of the equation, where I equals the logarithm base 2 of the number of states. More precisely, you have to include a weighted probability in each state. But for today, we can simplify it and assume all probabilities are equal. These states are distinguishable physical states. What does that mean? Suppose I toss a coin. It ends. It falls and will be either heads or tails. Those are two different distinguishable physical states. If I were to toss a two-headed coin, you wouldn't be able to distinguish one side from the other. And so you only have one distinguishable physical state. The logarithm of one is zero. You have no information. So this is the number of bits. So it's a simple concept to keep in mind. Distinguishable physical states is information. So this is where both classical and quantum information theory is based on. You can quantify this. Then there's what we call, sometimes called functional information. It is really a subset of what we call Shannon information. And it is a subset in that it says not just distinguishable physical states, but it's those distinguishable physical states that have some kind of function, meaning it's specified, it's meaningful, it's useful, it's valuable, contextual, it's got some value. And I'll show you some examples so this will be a little bit more clear. But it really takes a small subset of the standard information theory sets. What is important to remember here is that functional information cannot be quantified like Shannon information. Despite all attempts, you really cannot have a broad universal quantification. And again, we'll show some examples shortly. You can't quantify it, and it really doesn't lend itself to coherent manipulation, to mathematical formulas. You can't treat it like you can standard information theory. So keep this in mind. Also remember, and as we'll show, is that most people are interested in functional information and not in Shannon information. It's mainly physicists and communication engineers that like this. What's really interesting is functional information. There's a lot you can do with it, but it's important not to get it confused. This is not part of standard information theory. Now, what I'd like you to keep in mind through the rest of the talk here is some key considerations here. For example, what are the criteria for the physical information states? You know, that is to say, all right, how did I decide that it was a coin to be tossed? How do I decide it was a quarter versus a penny? You know, what are the criteria? That's fairly straightforward. Also, what is the criterion for the functional? How do you specify? What does functional mean? And how do we verify, once you have that criterion, how do you verify that a particular physical state meets that criterion? And finally, we're very interested in the question of intelligent agents. Are intelligent agents required for any of the above? Keep these questions in mind. They will be crucial for the conclusions of this particular talk. Now for some examples. The first example I want to give is that of language. Suppose we say that we'll have a sequence of 5 English letters. As you know, the English alphabet has 26 possibilities. And so if I calculate the information here, I could do that fairly straightforward way. The number of possibilities are 26 to the fifth. And I take the logarithm, I get 23.5 bits. What it basically means is it would take 24 zeros and ones in order to express every possibility. So we quantify this and say there's really 23.5 bits of information. And we can do quite a bit with that. That's quite valuable. It's almost 12 million different possibilities. Functional information, however, would be if we say, for example, let's talk about 5-letter English words. Okay, we rearrange it and you get an English word. Now, how many 5-letter English words are there? Well, if you open the dictionary and count them all night long, or Google it if you'd like, you don't get an exact answer. You don't get an equation. You don't get a crisp value. You say, well, there's at least 8,801. Well, if that were the case, that'd be about 13.1 bits. Okay. So I'd like you to note several things. First of all, it's a small fraction of the total. And that's almost always the case, that most definitions, functional information is a very small percentage of the total amount of information. But think about the questions I asked you about the criterion. First of all, the criterion of the physical states on Shannon information. Hey, why do we choose English? Okay. Well, you have to know the language in the first place, right? I mean, we could have picked Russian. We could have picked French. You get different answers. But once you set the criterion, you can write down the mathematical equation for it. So it's quantifiable because they're clear-cut definitions. When you come to functional information, what's the criterion? What's the criterion for deciding whether a combination of letters is a word? Well, you can say it's in the Oxford English Dictionary. Well, why pick that dictionary? Why not another? Well, which edition? It's going to change over time. And then push it one level back. On what basis do the editors decide that it is a word? You soon come to find out you can't write down an equation for it. These are abstract relationships that people deal with. Okay, remember that. There's also the question of intelligent agency. It's all over the map, everywhere. You had to have intelligent agency to develop the language. You had to have it to pick it in the first place. It's here everywhere. Shannon information, functional information. Virtually none of these things could operate without intelligent agents' work. All right, fairly clear example. Things get a little murkier, okay? Suppose you find a rock in the desert somewhere. Is there information there? Well, of course it is. You kind of intuitively know that a rock contains information from which you can determine whether or not it's a meteorite, how old it is, you know, and it contains information. Is that Shannon information? Absolutely. What are the distinguishable physical states? The atomic composition, the crystal structure. Why are those distinguishable? Because any given atomic composition can be distinguished from another. So it's distinguishable. And obviously, Avogadro's number is pretty big, so there's an awful lot of different compositions possible. So the amount of information in the Shannon sense is enormous. There's a lot of possibilities. But from that atomic composition, you can determine things like its age, its origin, and where it is. Now, is it functional information? Ooh, that's trickier. Well, depends. What kind of function are you looking for? What do you want? Are you asking if it's radioactive and can generate power because of all its energy, or function in terms of, well, you can throw it through a window and break a glass? What do you mean by functional information? It's not so clear. It's fuzzy. Is an intelligent agent necessary? Well, yes and no. On one hand, in order to do the abstraction from the atomic composition to an age in years, that's an abstract relationship that requires an intelligent agent connection. Okay. On the other hand, for most of the situations, you can think of some counterexamples, it didn't require an intelligent agent for the rock to be formed in the first place. It contained all that information when it supposed was a meteorite, came from outer space somewhere. It came with that information. No intelligent agent was required to generate the information. It was just required if you want to extract abstract relationships from there. Okay, let's get on with it. Let's go to DNA information. This is what we really want to talk about. And if you think of a genome in a simplistic way, very oversimplified, but you have about 3.5 billion base pairs in a human genome, for example. If you're thinking of this as Shannon information, where each nucleotide could be a different one of the four basic nucleotides, then the number of bits of information is the logarithm of 4 to the 3.5 billion power, which is 7 billion bits, which is an awful lot of combinations. It's an absolutely humongous piece. Now, as I said before, nobody really cares. This is kind of totally useless. This is just not where it's at. If you do anything like this, you can break this down into the gene level or into the protein level. But even there, the numbers are so off scale. And quite frankly, nobody cares. Because virtually all of these are useless. What we really want to deal with is functional information. Now, how are we going to decide functionality here? Well, you could be a lot of things. One of the things I'm going to assert here that's going to be important to our conclusions here, that what we typically mean in biology as functional information is a genome or genetic structure that has the information that enables the organism to survive to reproduction. Okay, I'll come back to this a little bit later, but if you think of every component, like if you ask, is this gene producing a protein? Well, okay, yes. But how do you know it's the right protein? What's the criteria? See, if you were building a computer and you were building it to add 1 plus 1, how would you know if you got the right answer? If you built it and it gave you an answer of 4, you know, it was obeying the laws of nature, everything worked perfectly well. But you know something is wrong. Why? Because you were verifying it with an abstract relationship that you knew that really required an intelligent agent. Now, what do we have here? How do you know you have the right protein? Who's to say you want this protein and not the other? I would suggest that ultimately what we call as functional in biology is whether that protein contributes and enables the organism as a whole to survive to reproduction. If it doesn't, that information is lost. It will never be repeated. It's gone. If it does reproduce, it'll try again. So, please note, this is a tiny, 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 minuscule fraction of the total. Okay, lots of zeros. It's very small. So you can easily see where a probability argument comes into play, simply because the probability of getting a functional information set out of a total set is, for all practical purposes, zero. So this is why I'm talking about functional information is what we talk about. It's not standard information theory. So that was my message number one. It's not standard information theory. Instead, the argument for information here is based on probability argument and, as I'll talk about later, a claim that functional information is necessarily linked to intelligent agents. More on that later. That's message number one that we kind of all agree on. Message number two, I'm going to try to show in the next few minutes that probability arguments are not valid for evaluating evolution. What do I mean by that? Well, I'm suggesting that probability arguments of any type, probability calculations, require a rather accurate knowledge of all possible mechanisms. Now, those of you who are physicists or chemists, you know very well that if you're calculating reaction rates or probabilities, that you really need to know the potential energy very well, in considerable detail, very sensitive, and you need to ensure that you're following the principle of least action. Or, if you're not a physicist, you might call this the path of least resistance or something. What does that mean? Well, a few examples here. Potential energy, suppose you want to calculate the rate at which water sloshes from a bucket to another one. Well, you kind of need to know how high the barrier is. You need to know how wide it is, its shape. You need to know how much energy is in the water to begin with. You need to know all these things. But in physics and chemistry, we know how to approximate things and get it in a form where we can do the mathematics. Okay, we're comfortable with that. We also know that we're exponentially sensitive to the value. And you better make sure there isn't another path where it can leak through. Right? We're familiar with that. But how would we apply anything like this to biology, where they don't know how to do mathematics? And you can't really calculate these things. You can't apply it. So let me suggest something. Let's consider an example of fish that swim upstream, going up the rapids. About two blocks from the ASA office is a dam across the Ipswich River. And we don't have salmon here that go up. However, we do have alewives, or river herring, or whatever you call them here. But alewives come up from the ocean up to this point, and you'd like to know what's the probability that you're going to make it up this dam, because it seems pretty clear these tiny fish are not going to make it up there. And it's pretty obvious that the probability of their getting up there is zero, no matter how you calculate it. But they make it up there. How? Well, you look a little closer, and you see that somebody built a fish ladder. That was very thoughtful. So there is another path by which the fish can swim up. It's still not that easy, but by taking a little step at a time, they can make their way up. So if you're going to calculate the probability of alewives swimming upstream, you have to make sure that you've found the most efficient fish ladder. You have to make sure that you've found the path of least resistance, the principle of least action. In physics, you have to calculate the probability of every path, and the largest contribution is going to be the one with the least action, the one that is easiest. They'll all come by. The moral of the story here is that, in general, whenever you're looking for a transition from one state to another, from evolutionary state of one to another, you need to make sure that you know all the possible mechanisms and that you can determine which is the path of least resistance. Which is the one most likely? Even if it's very circuitous, but if it's the one of least resistance, that's the one that's got the highest probability. The dilemma with evolution is that we don't know the mechanisms. We just don't know. There are so many. In terms of changes in genetic information, There are so many different kinds of mutations. You've got retroviruses that influence things. You've got horizontal gene transfer. You've got radiation effects. You've got all sorts of copy number variants. There are so many different ways that are influenced by the environment. And if you look in the past, there's no way of knowing what the environment was in the past in a detailed sense. And what you end up with is that you simply cannot determine all the possibilities. And yet, if you want to determine a probability or a path, you really have to make sure that you know and can verify that you've identified the right fish ladder. So this led Stuart Kaufman to write in a book called Biological Information, edited by Bob Marks and Michael Behe and Bill Dembski and John Stanford and Bruce Gordon. And he wrote, "If we do not know the sample space of the process of biological evolution, then probability calculations utilized by intelligent design scholars are also either moot or deeply suspect." In other words, he's using this term sample space. If you look at the fitness landscape and where things are, you have to understand all the space of the possibilities if you're even going to be close to tens of hundreds of orders of magnitude. You can't even make an estimate unless you know it. So for that reason, I would suggest that any probability calculation that's ab initio in terms of did evolution happen or not, whether you do single mutation, double mutations, whether you do any irreducible complexity calculations or free lunch theorems, none of them will work. Simply do not know enough to make the calculation. Okay? So for that reason, saying probability arguments aren't going to be very effective. Now, message number three. I think the intelligent design argument is keenly aware that even if you had a probability argument, that's not sufficient to get you to an intelligent designer. That's a negative. There needs to be a positive. And generally, this is where that second assertion comes in. All our experience shows that functional information needs to be connected with an intelligent agent. Where does that come from? What is the origin of that argument? And I would say basically that that is an argument from analogy. That this notion, all our experience is that intelligence is required, that experience is solely based on human design systems. They're all human design systems. Computers, language, numbers, you name it. Every example you see out there is a human design system. And the argument is that look at all the similarities. There's a code, a genetic code, like the code of language. There's symbolism, there's hierarchical structure, there's meaningful action, and the list goes on and on. And because of that, the argument goes that DNA information is complex and specified in an identical sense to that in human design systems, and therefore it must also have intelligent agents as a source. Now, first of all, I would say that arguments from analogy make for great explanatory illustrations, but they don't make for compelling logic. Because just because many attributes are the same doesn't mean that all attributes must be the same. It doesn't follow. And it's particularly vulnerable to critical differences. The analogy falls apart. And in my opinion, I would suggest that this is the situation here. I'm suggesting there's a crucial difference between the information systems and human design systems that require intelligent agents and the DNA system. Remember what we said before? The criterion for functionality, it's distinctively different. Why? Because functionality means the organism survives to reproduce. In other words, this is not an abstract relationship for which intelligence must be provided, as in every example of a human design system. Okay? However, in biology, this is a binary result. It either survives to reproduce or it doesn't. If it doesn't, that information set is gone. However, no intelligent evaluation is necessary in order to determine whether it does or not. It is a biological and physical process. That in itself is a fundamental distinction, because as I said before, the process of verifying whether something is functional or not, you know, the real question is, does that require intelligence? And that is where the connection comes in between functional information and intelligent agent. And without that, the analogy breaks down. You can't use the piece. So I like to call it an existential criterion, as opposed to an abstract relational criterion. And that I would suggest is a major distinction here. And we'll come back to that in a minute. But the question then is, if there is no information argument for intelligent design, then where did all this functional information come from? How did it come into place? And I would suggest that we can see that from observation. If we look at the biosphere instead of at human design systems, all our experience in the biosphere is that at every reproductive event, we generate new biological information. Every reproductive event. And many have argued, but wait a minute. All of that information is not new because it is pre-existing sequences. And I would suggest no, because the sequence of nucleotides, the information DNA, is always new. It's always different. It's a little bit like telling Beethoven and Mozart that they didn't create any new composition because they only used pre-existing notes. Just rearranged them a little. Well, the arrangement is the information. It's a different, distinguishable physical state. Each has function. It is new information. And in fact, the observed rates of change, we can't calculate the probabilities at which these changes are going to happen. Nobody knows this enough to happen. On the other hand, we can observe what is going on, and it's fairly consistent here. Now, the main objection here is, what about the origin of life? Because if you take the generation of functional information and say this is coming from reproductive events, you've got to get it started somehow. You really don't get it. And that's absolutely true, because we don't know. This is a mystery. And when Walter Bradley titled his book 30 years ago, The Mystery of Life's Origin, it's exactly correct. It's the best title, and it still is. It still is a mystery. Nobody knows the answer to the origin of life. But being a mystery just tells us a little bit of where to look. At this point, I don't really see any reason to believe that natural processes are inadequate, but we have not shown that they are adequate. That's part of the research to come into play. But I would suggest that the most probable areas for research are for systems that replicate with variation. This is the origin of biological information. You get the variation in the replication event. There you get new information at every step. So I would say that the real signature in the cell here is replication with variation, not the presence of an intelligent agent. So where does that leave us in terms of an intelligent designer? Well, perhaps not at the proximal level, but I would suggest that whereas the information argument here really doesn't hold up, the fact that it arises at each reproductive event leads us to an inference to the best explanation that the intelligent designer created and sustained nature to design all things. In other words, God, our intelligent designer, as the ultimate and the final cause rather than the proximal cause. Thank you very much.